Mobile workforces, cloud applications, and digitalization are changing every aspect of the modern enterprise. And with radical transformation come new business risks. Welcome to Hybrid Identity Protection, the premier podcast for cybersecurity pros charged with defending hybrid identity environments. Presented by Semperis, the pioneer of identity-driven cyber resilience for the hybrid enterprise. And now, here's your host, 15-time Microsoft MVP and Active Directory security expert, Sean Doobie.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the HIP Podcast. I'm Sean Doobie. By now, most organizations have built some kind of cyber attack incident response policies and assembled an IR team, though most with full-time jobs and other roles. But incident response is, hopefully, a very rare activity. What's it like? What lessons can we learn from someone whose full-time job is to support organizations undergoing cyber attack? They have a hard-earned perspective and knowledge of what threat actors do, and best practices to minimize the risk of your company being crippled by such an attack. Microsoft describes their DART, Detection and Response Team, as the Microsoft cybersecurity team we hope you never meet. Part of the company's cybersecurity solutions group, if you're a top-tier Microsoft customer, you can engage DART to provide reactive incident response and proactive security investigation services for your organization. Their services have been used by government and commercial entities around the world to help secure their most sensitive, critical environments. My guest today is Shiva P., senior consultant within the DART organization. Shiva's been with DART for 2 years. Welcome to the podcast, Shiva.
Thank you, Sean. Happy to be here.
What kind of hours do you work during an engagement? What's it like?
So it gets pretty intense, especially when I'm on a reactive engagement. Usually we sort of work around 13 hours or more based on the course of the engagement. But good thing is, we kind of decompress with sort of a comp off after an engagement. So DART encourages us to take enough time to decompress to prevent burnouts.
Right. Okay. So 13 hour days when you're on the engagement.
Yeah.
And as you said, what you describe as a reactive engagement. In other words, you're pulled in because somebody is under attack, right?
Right.
Okay. So when you're on an engagement like that, what sort of things do you do? What sort of tasks are you involved in?
Okay. So mostly it's incident response. It's sort of forensic analysis. We do log analysis. We sort of put together a story of what happened in the environment. And then we sort of simplify and explain these complex breaches that happened. And finally, we sort of outbrief, providing best practices and recommendation.
So you do forensic analysis through all of the log data that you can collect, and then basically present a story or a timeline to your clients of what has happened, and also you're actively involved in ejecting the threat actor?
Yes. So there's another team, subset of DART, which also helps with pushing the actor out and strengthens your Active Directory or any other endpoints and telling you what exactly are the options that you have to choose to prevent this from happening again.
That's the post-incident best practices. They got in this way, you want to close that sort of thing?
Yeah, that sort of thing.
I see. So this engagements means that you've been in a lot of war rooms over the last couple of years. I assume probably all of them have been virtual. I don't know if you've done any physical or not, but most people have never sat in an incident response war room. And of course, they never want to, but the next best thing is the experience of somebody that has. So what is it like? What is the war room environment like? And uh, what What kind of takeaways do you have from when you step into one of those situations?
So, yeah, I think mostly it is always intense, especially when an organization faces a breach, a cybersecurity breach for the first time. It is going to be a lot intense. There might be a lot of blame game happening around. There might be a lot of clashes between management and sort of the technical teams. There are also instances on the other side where it is easygoing. I mean, people understand what really happened and they know why we are there and they sort of put a really professional front and know that we are there to help. So both the sides.
That's the thing. And it's interesting when you talk about the clashes and management classes, and obviously that's not your area of expertise. And of course, Microsoft in general, and I'm sure Dart in general, and you in particular want to stay away from all of that, but you certainly observed a lot of that. Do you find that in these war room situations, is there commonly conflict about who reports to who or who has the authority to do what?
Yep, that's right. So it's about who reports to who owns a specific, let us say, an asset, or who does that specific service belong to, or who is responsible for security on it. There's a lot of commotions that happen, especially during such breaches.
Yeah, so in other words, lots of finger pointing, right?
Yep, a lot of it.
Yeah, it's not everybody stepping forward to say I own it. It's everybody. It's like the Homer Simpson GIF or GIF, you know, when he steps backwards into the bushes, everybody's like, no, that's not me.
Yeah, that's a lot of it that happens. Yeah.
You know, one of the things, the takeaways that I've got from having interviewed a lot of people in incident response is that, and actually Ben Kuhl, who is a cybersecurity incident response manager for Accenture in France, says that this is one of the single most important things that you can do is to have an incident response or emergency response org structure already put together. He calls it tear the envelope open, and here's the org structure for this. So that doesn't happen, because I'm guessing that while management is yelling amongst itself, your hands are more or less tied, right? You can't, there's things that you probably can't do for remediation until they figure it out.
Yep, that's right. Especially for the remediation part. Yeah, when something like this happens, it gets really, really difficult. And until they get to a point, it gets really quite hard to figure or to move this remediation part.
All right. So organization, incident response, emergency organization is an extremely important aspect of a solid incident response team. So let's get into some places where you can share your experiences over all these engagements. And why don't we follow the cyber kill chain sort of from the outside in as a guide. So when you do forensics, what have you found over the course of your engagements are the most common ways you see threat actors gaining initial access into an organization? I find, you know, the press on all of this, it tends to be overwhelming on either there's a heavy emphasis on all these different types of initial access, or in a report there's very little at all of what the initial access was. So it's really curious to know what you see as what are most common types of initial access.
Yeah, okay. So for initial access, especially let us first take on-premise infrastructure, it's going to be exploiting public-facing vulnerabilities for any sort of endpoints which is facing the public. And if it's not really patched, those are easy ones to basically pawn and for an attacker to come in. And the next part of that is phishing. That's another easy way for an actor to gain access to one of your machines. And especially if there is like weak security along with it, such as no MFA or MFA with SMS sort of an option, that also makes it even easier for an actor, combined with SIM swapping and all the other things that is currently happening at the moment.
Let's I'm curious, Shiva, and we're talking about these exposed endpoints. Can you give some examples of the most common exposed endpoints that you see being used?
Absolutely. Exposed endpoints can be any sort of a web server which is not patched, or there can be a blob of data sitting there which is not supposed to be exposed, and then you would have an RDP endpoint which is not supposed to be exposed sitting there with no proper security. There can be like APIs which is not properly secured, again exposed to the internet.
So you mentioned RDP sessions. So someone spins up a virtual machine or a physical machine on either on premises or in the cloud, and they haven't they don't tie in back end identity security into that.
Yep, exactly.
What about VPNs?
Yeah, so there are also VPNs either which has no proper MFA setup, or the VPN by itself has some sort of a vulnerability which is exposed, or that the VPNs are not properly configured.
Right. So anything that the threat actors can get at directly, it makes it a little bit easier. So phishing, you know, I think we all recognize that phishing is a very, very, very popular. Is that one of the most common attacks that you see?
Oh, yes. Phishing is like one of the most common attacks where attackers easily get access to your organization.
In our conversation before this recording, you mentioned that password stealing is by far the easiest method. Now, by that, do you mean accessing passwords from password dumps on the dark web, or what do you mean by that?
So compromised credentials, yes. So from there are human factors where there's the same sort of a password which is constantly being used, or some sort of small altercations to the main version of their passwords which is constantly used. And these sort of passwords which are basically compromised from either previous attacks or from their personal accounts end up in the dark web, and these passwords are then reused in such organizations.
You have a couple of interesting thoughts related to that. Is one, of course, is that if an organization becomes aware that credentials have been stolen, or particular passwords related to the credentials have been stolen on the dark web, obviously that the password should be changed. And I'm thinking back to the guidelines from a few years ago that Microsoft published, and of course now NIST has published, as far as password guidelines around changing passwords. So if your credentials have been dumped, you should change your password. But the other aspect of this is your users can't just change the password and add a 1 or a 2 or a 3 or a 4 on the dumped credentials, because that is essentially useless. It has to be something completely reset and completely different.
Exactly. It has to be completely reset, completely different. There should not be the same sort of a variation of the main password, and it has to be as random as possible.
How are you seeing in terms of these organizations that have been attacked? Do they have MFA installed?
Yes and no. So there are a few organizations which have MFA enabled, but unfortunately, we have seen from most of our engagements that either they have like the wrong or easier, a very much wrong versions of MFA, basically having SMS-based MFAs enabled, or they have like too many MFA policies that there are loops that they don't really know that there are loops.
Ah, I see. Too many exceptions.
Exceptions.
So like the executives that don't want to have MFA, which is
an
epic fail. You mentioned the vulnerabilities of SMS, and we've heard about the vulnerabilities of SMS for quite a while. And I know NIST has been recommending that using SMS for MFA should be deprecated. You mentioned that SIM swapping seems to be happening much easier. Can you outline what SIM swapping is and tell me why has it gotten easier nowadays? Or you said it's gotten more common. Is that accurate?
Oh, that's accurate. So it's nothing but, you know, let us say for an example, an actor already has access to your password from, let us say, a dark web or some other way of initial compromise where he was able to get access to one of your passwords. Now that you have MFA enabled, the organization basically has MFA enabled and it's, in, let us say, SMS based MFA, and he needs that code for him to get inside the organization. And the easiest way of basically doing that is SIM swapping. SIM swapping is nothing but basically reaching out to your telecom providers with additional details which has been previously reconnaissanced or got from the internet or the web from all about all your personal information. Using these two information, they reach out to the service providers and ask them to basically change the SIM card for any sort of reasons. It could be like I lost the SIM card, or they could state that, you know, their SIM card is not working. Examples like this. And when giving out these sort of personal information, especially with service providers not having enough security, enough secure way of authenticating that it is really you, they basically change that SIM card to the actor's own SIM card. So which means now all the information, all the operator, all the service basically comes to that specific SIM card, which is now controlled by the actor.
I see. So the actor gleans enough information about their target that they can pass identity verification on the provider. And then once they've done that, obviously fraudulent identity verification, that's when they can change the SIM to one of their phones.
Yep, that's right. So what happens after this is just requesting for, entering username and password and requesting for an MFA based on your SMS. And the SMS basically comes to the actor-controlled SIM card, which is actor-controlled own mobile phone. And that verification code is enough for him to get into your network.
Right. So moving away from SMS-based MFA, which we've heard about, but it's interesting to hear the details of what goes on in a SIM swap. Okay, so let's say they've gained access to an endpoint. What do they do next? Let's maybe take the scenario of a VPN access to a corporate network, to a on-premises network. What do the threat actors do next?
So as soon as, as soon as they land on an access, like an endpoint, the first thing that they do is persistence. And easy ones are basically creating a scheduled task or creating a backdoor, maybe using a RAT, or creating a startup script or modifying the startup scripts which are already there, or maybe even creating a user account with administrative privileges. And post that, it's going to be sort of escalation of privileges. So which means they could either do that by exploiting local vulnerabilities or maybe using Mimikatz to harvest credentials. And after which it is more of internal reconnaissance and lateral movement.
So we're still talking about, you know, VPN type or gateway type endpoint access. What is usually on the other side? What kind of a system is usually on the other side of the gateway that the threat actor is performing this kind of work on?
So after the VPN, it's going to be sort of an endpoint, and it can be any sort of workstation or a server to which the user has access to.
Okay, like a jump box or something like that?
Box, yes.
So what you have, the scenario that you have then is an endpoint that's exposed that accepts credentials, but not necessarily has MFA associated with it. And then the threat actors gain access to that. And this is obviously squarely in the realm of endpoint detection and response, EDR. And if they defeat or otherwise subvert the EDR, basically they can use tools to harvest. So I guess part of the scenario for this is there's a lot of admin access through this endpoint for systems for system maintenance, and even perhaps for vendors to come in through one of these endpoints. So there's probably a lot of admin credentials sitting in memory. And you're saying the threat actor, this is where the threat actor would harvest these credentials in memory?
Exactly. So basically, I mean, most of the jump boxes, not good hygiene. You would have a lot of administrators logging in. And especially if it's going to be an administrator or any user logging into these sort of boxes, it's easy to dump the credentials from the memory. And once this credentials are dumped, they use this credential then to move laterally inside your network.
Right. Okay. So let's take the other big use case, which is similar but slightly different, I think. A regular client, a PC client. So falls victim to a phishing attack. How does that process work? How is it similar and how is it different to what we just described?
Okay, so over here, what happens is, let us say there's like a normal user who has his credentials, he gives away his credentials. And for this scenario, let us also assume that somehow the actor circumvented the MFA policies due to different reasons. Yeah. At this point, let us assume that the actor has somehow now has access to most of the M365 applications or Office 365 applications. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Over here, the first thing or most of the times an actor would do is trying to figure out a lot of information about getting and installing their VPN clients and trying to get into your network. And once they basically get into your network, the next part of that is, again, trying to laterally move to different machines. And for that, either they must have some sort of an endpoint on which there is some sort of different users who has logged in based on what sort of whatever permissions, and post which it is going to be more of internal reconnaissance and again laterally moving until they find the right credentials. And this is going to be sort of a rinse and repeat method until they get to the maybe the Active Directory itself.
Right. Yeah, and until get to Active Directory. Okay, so are these attacks necessarily sophisticated? Or, you know, we read about all of these crazy sophisticated attacks. What do you see? At least, I mean, there are sort of two major categories. There is the cybercrime on one side, and there is nation state activity on the other. And let's focus on cybercrime, because I think most, you know, the probability of an organization that has been attacked, the probability that it is cybercrime versus nation state is probably much higher. So what's, you know, are cybercrime attacks necessarily sophisticated?
No. So a majority are motivated by monetary funds, and it is usually get in and get out. You'd not believe it. I've been on multiple engagements where I've seen attackers directly downloading scripts from GitHub and running it. As simple as that. There has been no change in codes, no masking, not even changing the file name. Just download the script and then execute it. And this is how simple it is. And this is how most of the cyber crimes are. Especially when they are motivated by monetary funds, it's like as quick as possible.
So if we take that experience we've seen this. I just saw a report. I just shared a report with you that talked about new lows that cybercrime actors are reaching to further coerce their victims, but the motivation being to make as much money as possible as quickly as possible. Does that mean that if your organization makes itself reasonably, if maybe not perfectly, but makes it that much harder than the next organization down the line to attack, is there a possibility that the threat actor won't continue and take the time to penetrate your greater defenses and just move on to the next one?
Yep, that's right. This is also what we have seen in multiple of our engagements, where we have seen actors giving up, especially if there are a proper defensive setup, and if you guys make it really, really hard for an actor to move from one place to another, or to get their hands on action or on objective, or to get to their impact, if it gets really hard, I don't think they would sustain and want to prove or try to get to a specific point, but rather they would just drop it and move on to the next organization, because in the end, it's more of money. And they would not really spend a lot of cycles doing or trying to propagate further into your network.
So that's a positive view of a positive aspect of it, I guess. And it's certainly not guaranteed, but to be able to say, look, if we make ourselves more secure, we do lower the risk of being attacked. So it's widely cited by other incident response organizations and by DART itself that Active Directory is almost always involved in an attack. Is that what you've seen in your personal experience?
Oh, yes. Active Directory is indeed a frequent target in most of the network-wide escalations during sort of cyber attacks. So in most of the incidents and case studies, attackers basically compromise Active Directory because it sort of serves as the backbone of the entire organization. So getting access to that is a goldmine, and they would have like a humongous amount of things that they can do, a lot of privileges if they basically compromise the Active Directory itself.
What kind of attacks do you see them do against Active Directory?
So we've seen pass the hash, pass the ticket. We have seen a lot of NTDS.dit being exfiltrated. We've seen Kerberos roasting. We've seen both the silver tickets and the golden ticket attack. There are times when we have also seen DC sync happening, and also deployment of ransomwares via GPOs. Those are also something that we have seen before.
Right. Yeah, so the use of policy deployment used for evil rather than just than for good.
Exactly.
Have you seen instances where Active Directory is virtualized and the threat actors gain control of the virtualization, I guess you would call them virtualization operator role, so that they get control of the hosts themselves?
Oh, yes, we have also seen where Active Directory has been virtualized from backups, basically to access the databases.
Oh, just pulling the DIT database right off of the backup.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. So let's talk about, let's say we are in this cyber kill chain here. Let's talk about the ransom part. So at this point, Active Directory has been compromised. Other endpoints have been compromised, databases probably been compromised. And so this is where the ransom comes in. So Semper has just published a ransomware survey. And in that survey, the majority, more than 75%, felt compelled to pay ransom. What's Microsoft's position on paying ransom?
So both Microsoft and DART, we don't encourage it because it basically paints you as an easy target for other threat actors. And it makes you an easy target going on. Especially, it also goes to a point of where you become a low hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm. Well, that ties into what this survey also says, which is that a full 75%. I'm sorry, 72% of the paying companies had to pay more than once, which is, it fits right in with your, it sounds, it paying more than once is interesting and in quick succession. So 35% and towards whether or not you should pay ransom, 35% of survey respondents that paid ransom either didn't receive decryption keys or their keys were corrupted and unusable. So it sounds like you really put yourself in a bad situation if you really feel that you're compelled to pay ransom. A surprising number of survey respondents that were attacked, 74%, that said that they were attacked in quick succession, sometimes as little as a week or even a few days. Do you have any theories as to why that might be?
Yeah, so one of that which straight away comes to my mind is that, especially if you're attacked for the first time, and you're exposed to significant security weaknesses and vulnerabilities inside and operational issues, there are times when you are attacked like more than once in rapid succession. The other parts of that is it could be that incomplete patch management as an issue, or there could be residual backdoors or missing IOCs that might also have reasons why this sort of attack, which happens in quick session succession, happens. Sometimes it also sort of becomes a pylon effect, let's say, where multiple group targets the same organization due to the initial successful attack and also insider knowledge from the first attack.
Right. So you have the threat actors establish persistence in some unknown corner, or often we've seen this where they'll establish persistence in Active Directory so they can get back in and continue or come back later. And the other is what I think of it, as you said, pylon, or I think of it as sharks with blood in the water, where, as you said, they're, you know, showing to be vulnerable, and other threat actors can jump in on top of that as well.
Yep.
So finally, you know, we've talked a lot about how things go wrong in these situations. What do you and Microsoft recommend from your experience to make yourself less of a target? Or if you do become a target, how to minimize the impact to your business and ultimately how to avoid paying ransom? Because we're seeing the numbers that say paying ransom is not in and of itself a solution. It often sets you up for things down the road as well.
So the first one is implement strong access control, a least privilege principle, make sure to enforce MFA, and make sure it is also properly implemented. Do not go for SMS based, and you know, especially now that SIM swapping has become really easy. The next part of that is patch management and vulnerability management. Do not accept risks and keep growing that risk document larger. Try to find alternatives and challenge such requests and make sure that it's like properly patched and properly managed.
Is that, Shiva, I just wanted to stop you for a second and ask you there. So this is that fine line that organizations walk that says either, you know, implement a patch immediately and hope that it doesn't break anything on one end, or go through proper testing and change management process to implement the patch for the vulnerability and become a choice healthcare, change healthcare. That's what you're saying, right? Don't wait too long. I guess is where I'm going on this, right?
Don't wait too long and make sure to have those patches, especially based on the severity. Make sure to have that in place, or at least workarounds. Yeah, so that, you know, when something of this sort happens, you're not at a very bad state.
Okay. All right. We'll continue. What other recommendations?
I would definitely suggest network segmentation. Make sure to identify and isolate critical systems and crown jewels. Implement internal firewalls, a proper access control between segments to prevent unauthorized accesses. Another thing that is important is backup strategy. Make sure to have backups. And there should always be monitoring and threat detection. Make sure you have proper visibility, collect those logs, have it monitored. Create threat detections, use EDR solutions, and make sure that you do see every single thing that's happening around. And that doesn't mean that I'm asking you to collect all sort of logs everywhere around your network. No, make sure to estimate all the cost that is involved, of course, for such logs. But have those assets and have those logs accessible so that if something like a breach of sorts happens, you know where to go get these logs from.
What about proactively? You say you make some of these changes. What about proactively testing those changes? Do you have any recommendations around that?
Absolutely. Use your red team to find such flaws. in your security proactively. And from these findings, make sure to protect and increase that visibility and make it really hard for an actor when they do the same sort of thing that your red team has done.
Because what we've established here is that under most circumstances, the threat actor is going to find the easiest way to get in. So that's what the pen testing is trying to do, exactly the same thing. Yes?
Yep.
What about user education?
Oh, yes. Training and awareness is really, really important. Make sure your user is constantly trained on phishing. You don't really have to name and shame them, but make sure that they're always thinking about such emails on the back of their head that, you know, they would all at any time be phished, even if it is internally. And there is also another part of that is incident response drills for the security team. Have that done at least twice a year or maybe more based on how big your, how frequent you can do, how frequent you can do for your team. Have those drills done constantly, because that is another training and awareness that really helps for an incident response team when it faces something of this sort of, when they basically face a breach.
We focused on a lot of on-premises security, and organizations that are moving to the cloud often do the old lift and shift, where they take virtual machines and they simply move them from your on-premises network into your cloud network. What about controls in the cloud versus controls on-premises? Or maybe the question is the relative expertise of an organization to apply security in those situations.
Yeah, so we have seen time and again that lift and shift to the cloud is not really enough. It is not really going to work. It's completely different from your infrastructure controls to what's happening on the cloud. It's going to be completely different. You have to basically educate and make sure that the right controls are set up. You cannot just pick it up from there and then place it on the cloud and expect things to work. That's not exactly how it works, and you'll have to ensure that proper controls are in place, proper monitoring is in place, proper security team is looking into it and understanding what sort of attacks these are. And these sort of things are really, really important.
Well, thank you, Shiva. This has been a very informative, informative and maybe scary session. I think that... Well, maybe it's been scary, but to my mind, the positive things that have come out of this is, look, this is what the threat actors do. They go the simplest way in as possible to get in, get their money, and get out. You focus on those that low hanging fruit that they're looking at. That's what you need to look at, and should they gain access. The other aspect of this, of course, is the resilience of your organization to either eject them or, if they have damage, to be able to recover quickly. And the ultimate goal being to not pay ransom and keep your organization up. Thank you, Shiva. I appreciate the time. I hope you thought this was interesting as well. So,
thank you. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it. Thank you for having me here.
Thanks for joining us on the Hybrid Identity Protection Podcast with Sean Duby. Be sure to subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. Visit hipconf.com, that's HIPCONF.com, to learn about upcoming events, view expert presentations, and take part in the conversation.